This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The year was 1908, and an Ohio doctor appointed by President Theodore Roosevelt as the nation's first opium commissioner warned that Americans had become the greatest drug fiends in the world. This was the country's first opioid crisis. There are lots of similarities and some shocking differences between current times and a drug crisis that dates all the way back to the Civil War. Washington Post national security correspondent Nick Miroff writes about America's long and difficult history with opioids in an article for the Post. I recently spoke with him. Nick, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
How did this particular opiate crisis, as I understand it, the first time the nation had ever faced an opiate crisis, what led up to this? How did this get its start?
Well, opioids like morphine and opium itself were in a lot of popular medicines in the 19th century. They were especially effective at treating coughs. And you got to remember, there were a lot of respiratory infections back then. A lot of people suffered from whooping cough, tuberculosis, things like that. And they were also very effective at treating diarrhea. So they were often sold as antidiarrheal drugs in a time when there was a lot of bad water. And then, starting particularly after the Civil War, you had a lot of injured veterans who were in a lot of pain and had been given morphine on the battlefield. A lot of them continued to have to struggle with addiction for the rest of their lives throughout the second half of the 19th century. And you also just had this totally unregulated pharmaceutical industry, essentially, of everything from, companies that were producing what we would think of as like fairly standard over-the-counter drugs to the kind of, hucksters that were selling all kinds of different cure-all formulas. But things like laudanum, which is essentially opium in alcohol, were extremely easy to obtain and were widely abused. And just as now, the kind of addiction crisis of the 19th century really cut across all demographic lines, and there were a lot of middle class, so-called society ladies who were hooked, and it built up into a bigger and bigger crisis.
So you're talking about these being in a lot of popular drugs. Were they even given to kids at the time?
They were. There were, if you can go back, and the DEA has a lot of these at its museum in Arlington, but you can go back and look at early advertisements for some of these drugs, including, like throat lozenges that were made with, opium and even heroin. We know when heroin was first introduced by the Bayer Company, as a more powerful alternative, to its popular drug aspirin. Heroin, in German, I understand, means heroic or strong. And when it was marketed here, it was marketed as a non-addictive alternative to morphine. And it was introduced in several forms, in cough syrup, and even in throat lozenges. And many of these drugs were recommended for children for diarrhea in particular.
Yeah, they were even marketed to families and children. In your article, you show some old ads that illustrate mothers giving these to their kids.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, one of the popular cough syrups, I forget the name right now, it's in the story, but one of the most popular cough syrups that was monitored, that was offered, had a dose of powerful opium in it. And if you can actually go back and look at some of the early clippings from around the turn of the century, when several infants died of overdoses. And I think this is, this was one of the things that got people increasingly to pay attention to this problem and to the lax regulation of these products, was that, mothers were overdosing their babies because they were coughing or because they had diarrhea, and they gave them too much opium and they sadly, overdosed.
So when doctors are prescribing opioids, we can see how this crisis began and then ballooned out of control.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the parallels are really striking. Once again, it was kind of the lax regulation of companies that were selling these drugs and downplaying their addictive properties, and tons of people getting hooked. Now, there are huge differences, obviously, and a big one is that, you know, these doses of opium and morphine in the 19th century weren't nearly as potent as the drugs that hit the market in our generation.
Right, they weren't dealing with the influx of synthetic opioids that we're seeing today, right?
Certainly nothing like, you know, fentanyl or even the like more concentrated heroin, you know, that people use now or would use later on. But still, it was a major national crisis, sufficient enough that in 1908, Teddy Roosevelt named America's first opium commissioner, whose job it was to work with countries like China and in Europe to formulate some of the world's first international drug laws to try to control the flow of opium and opioid products into the United States.
Nick, can you give us some of the numbers on the percentage of our population addicted by the peak of the 19th century crisis?
The estimates vary, and there isn't a lot of good data on this, but I've talked to experts who think that as many as 300,000 Americans by the turn of the century were hooked on opioids, and that includes products like laudanum, but also morphine and some intravenous drug use. But again, that can range from everything from wounded veterans to some of the folks that ended up in the opium dens of San Francisco and New York, that became a big social outcry. And you also got to remember that what changed was that moving into the 20th century was the progressive era, and there was a broader societal effort to sanitize America's teeming urban areas and to also crack down on alcohol abuse. I mean, this was the period that led to prohibition, and America's drug problem was very much kind of wrapped up in this sense of moral and social decay.
So you're saying the temperance movement overlapped between drugs and alcohol?
Exactly. And for the same reasons, so did the birth of the first kind of, organized criminal drug trafficking groups. And many of them were famous bootleggers, and figures like Arnold Rothstein, who's famous for fixing the 1919 World Series, but also as a major alcohol bootlegger, is considered one of the first drug traffickers. And, by then the epidemic of addiction had diminished significantly, but that was really when we saw the first, formation of the first kind of drug trafficking organizations, and narcotics really becoming like a big part of an organized crime portfolio would be.
So by estimates, 300,000 people were addicted back in at that time. Today we have 10 times as many people who are addicted, which just seems amazing. It's just such a huge number.
Yeah, I mean, it still goes without question that our current epidemic is the worst in American history. This is the only other period that maybe rivals it. And again, we don't have great numbers on just how bad the problem was, but it still seems to pale in comparison to what we're seeing now, both in terms of the number of people who are hooked and obviously the overdose deaths.
Nick, how did the invention of the hypodermic needle contribute to this first crisis?
Well, it accelerated it. I mean, the hypodermic needle, As I understand it, was went really into widespread use for medical purposes in the 1860s and during the war in particular, and it was immediately recognized being such a much more effective way to administer pain medicine like morphine. But then, after the war and for the rest of the late 19th century, you could just order hypodermic needle kits through like the Sears catalog, and they would come with doses of opium or morphine. You could just, you know, order them really through the mail. And they had included, you know, instructions for self-injection and that sort of thing. And the, you know, the immediacy and the potency of the high was much greater. And that seems to have contributed to the addiction crisis as well.
Were the doctors at the time wary of opiates?
They were. And one of the really interesting things about this period, and I would recommend, for those who are interested, there's some excellent work on this by the University of North Florida historian named David Courtwright. But essentially, what happened was the medical community began to grow very concerned about the abuse of painkillers and of opiates, and began really to police itself. Doctors, I think, saw that the government and the kind of temperance movement were really starting to target these drugs, and they were worried about losing their access to them for legitimate purposes. And at the same time, there were a ton of unscrupulous doctors who were out there writing prescriptions for these drugs and giving them to people simply to maintain their addictions. So you saw this kind of effort among consider them responsible doctors to push some of these laws, but to also really to police their own and to kind of ostracize those in their profession that were kind of, viewed as dope dealers. And again, you know, they at the same time really, advocating for their ability to preserve their access to them for the purposes of surgery and things like that.
So doctors began policing themselves. What were some other things that happened that eventually brought this first opiate crisis under control?
Well, the government really cracked down. They banned the import of opium, for non-medical purposes. And really that was like the large scale, importation of opium. They cracked down on opium dens. Some of the first drug laws in the United States were aimed at, opium dens of San Francisco in the 1870s. So you saw this growing effort to control, the entrance of opium and opium products into the United States. To regulate the companies that made these drugs. And at the same time that doctors were policing themselves, I think the big difference was that there just wasn't an organized crime structure that could step in when the government, took this stuff off the market. So, in general, there was just a declining number of addicts. These substances weren't widely available, and there was no drug cartel that could step in and continue to supply them, once they disappeared from the black market.
How long did it take for them to get this crisis under control eventually?
I mean, really, it took at least a generation. I mean, as I understand it, these trends were happening even before the government really stepped in a big way to regulate opium and the opioid crisis in the early 19-teens, particularly with some of the first drug laws and the Narcotics Control Act. But it took a long time. It's a long process. And when anyone who works in substance abuse will tell you, sometimes it takes, a generation, because there are people who are really always going to be hooked. And the key to getting through a crisis like this and to getting on top of it, the most important thing is to prevent new addicts from getting hooked.
Yeah, and so clearly we won't be able to solve our current crisis by just waiting around for it to taper off on its own.
No, it's not going to happen by tapering off on its own, but it's also not going to happen overnight. If you look at this history and you look at the history of addiction in the United States, there have always been, anytime there has been a kind of wave of addiction, the lingering effect of it is that there is a a population of people who just never get over it and who need, maintenance therapy, or who end up really sick or dead, because this kind of addiction is so powerful and it's so difficult to overcome.
It's interesting. Your article, you show a billboard from Chillicothe, Ohio, and it's a billboard for naloxone.
Sure. I mean, naloxone is out there everywhere. It's entered the kind of, popular lexicon. It's carried by police officers and first responders almost all over the country now, and it's used widely, and a lot of addicts know how to use it too, and even kind of keep an eye on themselves and on each other. And one of the perverse effects of this is that, as naloxone is available, opioids are getting more and more potent. And so substances like fentanyl that deliver, all accounts, a high that's even more intense than, what a heroin user would get, within the addicted community, there's a kind of subculture of like really, pushing it right to the edge, getting as stoned as you can, knowing that the naloxone can always bring you back.
Nick, does the fact that they were able to bring this under control in the early 1900s, does that give hope for what we're facing nowadays in this latest opiate epidemic?
I think it gives some hope, but it's a limited hope. Again, there isn't a, the difference then was that I think that, doctors and the government working together could do a lot to bring it under control. And today we're dealing with this criminal element of drug cartels that is able to supply on the black market substances that can end up disappearing through regulation. But we also have to keep in mind that, I think if you compare prescription levels of opioid painkillers in the United States to the rest of the world, we're still by far highest in the world. And so there's both a lot of opioid painkillers that are going out through normal channels, as well as this incredible abundance of these substances on the black market.
Nick, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Washington Post national security correspondent Nick Miroff. You can find a link to his article at wvxu.org.